Lots going on, and I obviously am not going to be able to talk about everything, but let's look at a couple of these things. Firstly, let's look at the Uzzah way. David has come to Jerusalem. He's set up his house there, and the people are all united now behind him. It's time now to make this good thing better. And the way in which they can do that is to collect and unite Israel at Mount Zion. David's proposal is to find the Ark of the Covenant, which has been moving around with the tabernacle in the area around Benjamin, and to bring it into the city of David. Now, you may be surprised that I call this the Uzzah way, and I'm not particularly a fan. I'm not a fan of the Uzzah way. We're inclined to actually be sympathetic to Uzzah, aren't we? I mean, the Lord's anger breaks out on Uzzah, whose only desire, it seems, is to keep the ark from falling off the cart into the ditch. Most of us, in a similar circumstance, would reflexively do the same thing if we saw something that was falling. Now, here's the issue. Uzzah's reflexive act is not merely an impulse to help something, to keep it from falling, that then ends in an overbearingly harsh consequence. Uzzah's placing his hand on the ark is actually the result of years of training and practice. As a member of the high priest family, he would have known the regulations that governed how it is that the Ark of the Covenant was to be transported, how the tabernacle was to be moved. This event here is not the fruit of a moment. It is the fruit of years of disregard, of making excuses, of casual familiarity, of living lax, and neglecting God's commands. Uzzah and Ahio knew that the ark was to be carried on poles by a priestly clan that had been given the responsibility of moving the tabernacle. David has 30,000 of the chosen men of Israel together with him in his procession. It wasn't for a lack of personnel that they couldn't carry the ark as the Lord prescribed. They made choices. And so they put the ark in what do we read? An ox cart. Is it only an ox cart? Does it say just an ox cart? It was moved by ox power, right? But what kind of cart it is? We read that it was a new cart. A new cart. Now that's one of those, and this is one of those places where a detail is significant, but it's easily looked over and discounted. And if we're not curious, we actually miss something that's pretty significant. What's significant about a new cart? If you know the history of what's been going on in 1 and 2 Samuel, and I haven't preached about the early parts of 1 Samuel, if you had read that, it might help and bring some clarity as to the seriousness of this episode. In the early chapters of Samuel, we read that Eli and his sons, Hophni and Phinehas, use the ark as a kind of a talisman. They take it into battle against the Lord's command, against the Philistines, thinking that they can force the Lord's hand to give them victory over Philistia. The Lord, though, is not with them, and as a consequence, Israel is routed. They're driven from the field, and the ark is left behind and taken by the Philistines, who now think of it as a trophy to their God who gave them victory over the Lord. So they put the Ark of the Covenant in the temple of Dagon, who is the Philistines' god. And they rest it right there at Dagon's feet. Now, just because Israel is defeated, and just because they have taken the ark, doesn't mean that the Lord himself can be taken captive. Each morning, the priests go in to offer their sacrifices and minister before this idol, the idol of Dagon, and they find that the idol has fallen over and is lying at the feet of the ark. It seems that Israel's Lord is the God of all gods. Philistia suffers. Plagues break out. They realize, you know, over a course of months that they can't keep the ark of the Lord or the Lord captive. And after 7 months, the Philistines ask their own priests and some diviners, right, some holy men, what it is that they should do. And we read in 1 Samuel 6 that they say, you need to send the ark back to Israel. You need to get that out of here. You need to place an offering in it. They're going to put some gold things in it, and you need to send it on. So what do? They place the ark on what? A new cart. You see, Ahio and Uzzah have had their worship imaginations more trained by the Philistines than by the Word of God. We are all too easily convinced that we can employ the technologies and means of the world as a way to serve the Lord. The Lord is not a God who is a God who can be put in his place, like David seems to be doing, even if he's doing it with a lot of pomp and circumstance. The Lord's presence in Philistia in 1 Samuel 5 and 6 throws down idols and plagues Philistia with... They experience these plagues, and what happens is they have growths or tumors, right? They suffer from all these physical maladies. And it's as if the Lord is saying that he is not going to share his presence with idols, hence the idol of Dagon falls over, nor is he going to leave the people untouched by the sin that resides beneath their skin. Right, David, he wants the presence of the Lord. And he seems to think that if he can put the Lord in his place, the Lord will stay there. Friends, the Lord of creation is not a God who stays put. Rather, he is a God who breaks out. His presence in our lives is not something that will leave us unchanged. He topples false worship in our hearts, and he brings to light hidden malignancies. Our problem is that we think of these, you know, let me just say, that's heavy. Right? We need to let that sink in. We come to a problem, though. And the problem is that we think that there are really only two options. We think that if I come and give myself to him, I will be destroyed in the process, right? I can have God and be destroyed, or I can kind of manage my own existence and, you know, maybe I can live some way. It's David's conundrum in verse 9, right? He says, how can the ark of the Lord come to me? If this is who God is, if God is a God who breaks out, how is it that the ark of the Lord can come to me? See, this Uzzah way is literally, figuratively, metaphorically, actually a dead end. It doesn't take you anywhere. Right? We can't hope to contain or manage or maintain a God who breaks out. That's the Uzzah way. Now, secondly, is the Michael way. Just as with Uzzah, right, we're tempted, you know, we're maybe naturally disposed to be sympathetic to Michal. Michal was Saul's youngest daughter. She occupied a place in the family similar to David in that she was the youngest. After witnessing David's exploits, his defeating of Goliath, his fighting, you know, with the Philistines, we read in 1 Samuel 18 that Saul's daughter Michal loved David. And just a few verses later, we read that Saul used Michal's love for David to manipulate David into fighting the Philistines. We don't read that David loved Michael. Maybe he was only ambitious to be Saul's son-in-law, right? How David's disposition to Michael is actually something that's hidden to us in the scriptures. But it is Michael who is responsible for saving David's life when she warns him of Saul's plan to murder him in 1 Samuel 19. David owes his life to Michael, to her quick and clever actions. And once David is on the run, it seems that David's relationship with Michael is over. King Saul eventually gives Michael to another man named Palti, the son of Laish, and we read about that in 1 Samuel 25. Now, since Michael had been first given to David, David has acquired many wives, which we talked about last week. Michael now, though, is back on the scene, but before she is back on the scene, there are these negotiations that have to be opened that we didn't read about, but took place in 1 Samuel 3 between David and Ish-bosheth. And that's when we're first reminded again that David and Michael were married. But you know, who knows what 10 years apart or more will do to you? It seems that in David's eyes, Michael might be no more to him than a trophy wife who gives legitimacy to his kinship because she is Saul's daughter. And for that matter, Michael is the daughter of a king, and she may imagine herself as only being worthy of a king. Right? If being a trophy husband was all that David was for her now, it seems that she expects a bit more shine from him in the way in which he behaves and comports himself, a shine that might reflect more favorably on her. Now, unlike his previous attempts to put the Lord in his place, David now seems to be a man who has humbled himself. He wears the linen ephod, that is the robe or the garments of a priest who is ministering, serving before the Lord in his tabernacle. His nakedness there appears to be humble and vulnerable. Unlike Philistia, David has nothing to hide. He has nothing to hide beneath his skin. And if there's anything foul underneath, David is inviting the Lord to show, and he is allowing the world to see what tumors of trouble or boils of sin lie underneath. And as David leads this procession into Jerusalem, something, though, boils up in Michael. The love with which Michael loved David, the love which moved her to rescue David and to lie to her father, seems to turn. It sours. And we read in verse 16, as the ark of the Lord came into the city of David, Michael, the daughter of Saul, looked out of the window and saw King David leaping and dancing before the Lord, and she despised him. She despised him in her heart. That's significant. Despising is not something that really evokes sympathy. Despising isn't just sour, it's ill will. This change in Michael's heart leaks out as she sarcastically confronts David in verse 20. And David returned to bless his household, but Michael, the daughter of Saul, came out to meet David and said, "How the king of Israel has honored himself today, uncovering himself today before the eyes of his servants, female servants, as one of the vulgar fellows who shamelessly uncovers himself." Why is David there? Why has David come to his house? Is this the way one is to receive the Lord's anointed when he comes to bless? How is it? Think about this. How is it that people are naturally inclined to receive the Lord's anointed? Right? When he comes to bless, what do they do? Well, we read actually about that in the Gospels. He's from Nazareth. Can anything good come from Nazareth? He has a demon. we know who his father is. He trusted in God. Let God deliver him. Right? And what of his way? What of the Lord's anointed's way? How does the Lord who breaks out, the Lord who topples idols and reveals what is hidden, how does the Lord who will not be handled, how does he come to us? That's the anointed's way. Now, when Uzzah dies, everything stops. We read in verse 6 that David was angry because the Lord had broken out against Uzzah. Maybe not the best reflexive kind of emotion to well up in a moment like that. But we get angry when boundaries are crossed. And David obviously had his boundary lines marked a little wrong. As he moves from anger to the realization and to the understanding, right, we see that David's idol of his own self-importance tumbles and the sin of his presumption rises to the surface. He begins to see it. David wasn't here to help the Lord. David had no privilege. He has nothing to offer. David wasn't carrying the Lord to put the Lord into his place. It was the Lord who, from the very beginning, had marked and set aside David and was carrying and bringing him to the place that the Lord himself had chosen for David. Right? And David now rightly understands his predicament. We read in 9 and 10, and David was afraid of the Lord that day, and he said, "How can the ark of the Lord come to me?" So David was not willing to take the ark of the Lord into the city of David, but David took it aside to the house of Obed-Edom the Gittite. Now, when we are confronted by the reality of who God is, we find ourselves stalled and stuck. How is it that we can move forward? How is it that the presence of the Lord, and here, right, that's what the Ark of the Covenant signified, or you can maybe even go so far as to say embodied. How is it that the presence of the Lord could come to me? Right? If I don't have the Lord, I can never be saved. But if I have the Lord, I have no guarantee that safe will mean what I think it should mean. And the Ark of the Lord, we read, remained at the house of Obed-Edom the Gittite 3 months. But, we also read, and the Lord blessed Obed-Edom and all his household. Friends, the Lord comes to you to bless you. Right, what was it like for Obed-Edom and his household? Do you think that they turned the Ark of the Covenant into a coffee table? Like they rested their feet on it while they ate chips and watched the game? You know, absolutely not. The Ark of the Covenant was something whose presence was treated fearfully and carefully, right? It was a room that you didn't just kind of run into. It was a piece of furniture that you moved carefully around and kept your eyes on. Right? In Obed-Edom's house now, the Ark of the Covenant was the most important thing in their house. The presence was the central reality of the house. And what was the result of that transformation in that house? Blessing. Blessing. And David returned, right? Blessing was the result. And why is it that David has come to his house? Right? This Lord's anointed David, right, returned to bless his house. And when Michael sarcastically rebukes David, David puts her in her place, saying, "It was before the Lord who chose me above your father and above all his house to appoint me as prince over Israel, the people of the Lord, and I will celebrate before the Lord. I did not dance," he is saying, "for your pleasure or approval. You still think you're better than me, don't you? You think that I am your trophy husband, but I'll tell you what, I am king over you. And the house of Saul has come to nothing. Do you think that I have humiliated myself in doing so? Here's the thing. When the Lord's anointed comes with blessing, comes with the purpose to bless, and he comes in humility, his people are not humiliated by that. Rather, his humiliation lifts his people up. As one of David's later descendants, who herself called herself a servant of the Lord, said, "He has shown his strength with his arm. He has scattered the proud in the thoughts of their hearts. He has brought down the mighty from their thrones and exalted those of humble estate. He has filled the hungry with good things, and the rich he has sent away empty." Friends, the Lord's anointed has come, and he comes to you to bless you. He comes to you with a meal. How is it that you will receive him? Do you think that you can have his blessing while keeping him at arm's length, by keeping him in his place? Right? The Lord will not, I'm sorry, have you on those terms. He is a God who breaks out. And what of the feast that he offers? You know, will you turn your nose up at juice and crackers, saying, "This is a poor person's meal. This is the kind of food that people who've come to the end of their paycheck and have nothing else to eat, eat." Or do you see in the bread and the cup what the prophet Isaiah calls the richest affair? Do you see the Lord's anointed who gives himself to give you life? Do you see the one who shed his blood to seal your salvation in himself? Do you receive the Lord in such a way so as to give him sway in your life, to cast down idols in your life, and to deal with the sin that is beneath your skin? Do you see the Lord Jesus Christ who has come to bless you? In receiving him, in taking him into yourself, right? Though he receive you as you are, he will not leave you as you are. Can you give yourself to him?